You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 25th of February 2020 on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in partnership with Rolex. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up...
We're very opposed to the authoritarian nature of Cuba. But, you know, it's unfair to simply say everything is bad.
Is Fidel Castro going to get Donald Trump re-elected? Also ahead, former Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak dies at the age of 91. Later in the show...
Ireland has the same position as the European Union now, I think, when we say that the backstop is part of a balanced package that isn't going to change.
Irish Foreign Affairs Minister Simon Coveney attempting optimism last year. We'll meet Belfast author Glenn Patterson to consider the view from the other side of the border. Plus, we'll ask whether a few stalling infrastructure projects should prompt a rethink of the idea of German efficiency, and we'll review the morning newspapers, and our news panel will wrap up the day's other big stories. All that coming up right here on The Briefing on Monocle 24. And welcome to today's edition of The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders is not yet the Democratic Party's nominee for President of the United States, but he is now the front runner and is therefore now attracting a front runner's scrutiny, not least over remarks such as this.
We're very opposed to the authoritarian nature of Cuba. But, you know, it's unfair to simply say everything is bad. You know, when Fidel Castro came into office, you know what he did? He had a massive literacy program. Is that a bad thing? Even though Fidel Castro did it?
There's a lot of dissidents imprisoned in Cuba.
That's right. And we condemn that. Unlike Donald Trump, let's be clear. I do not think that Kim Jong-un is a good friend. I don't trade love letters with a murdering dictator.
Bernie Sanders, like many left-wingers of a certain vintage, did harbour a certain sappy fondness for the interminable dictatorship of Fidel Castro in Cuba. And Sanders, like many left-wingers of a certain vintage, is not a man quick to consider the possibility that he may have been wrong about anything. The question is how many American voters are likely to agree with Sanders, especially in Florida, where winning is likely going to be necessary to defeat President Donald Trump in November. I'm joined with more on this by Scott Lucas, Professor of American Studies at the University of Birmingham. Scott, first of all, is this likely to be a significant liability for Sanders should he get the nomination?
No, I don't think so, Andrew, because I don't think Cuba will be on the top of many Americans' list in terms of the issues they're concerned about. It could, however, have special resonance, as you mentioned, in the state of Florida, with a large Cuban-American population. And of course, well, we're going on now close to 70 years of very heated rhetoric, often overshadowing substance on the Cuba issue. I think the more immediate issue for Sanders, however, is not whether it causes him trouble versus Donald Trump. It's whether it causes him trouble as we get into the next stage, the critical stage of the Democratic race to get the nomination.
On that specific front, then, is that a vulnerability? Because Florida is clearly going to be important. It always is. Is it likely to be a thing that his rivals for the Democratic candidacy say it doesn't really matter whether or not you might agree with Senator Sanders? If he can't win in Florida, he cannot win this election.
Well, his rivals have already jumped on the Cuba comments. In fact, being quite partial how they represent them, but to precisely to try to undermine and challenge Sanders with a view on the Florida primary, the issue there is whether Bernie Sanders sweeps the board, as it were, on Super Tuesday, which is 14 states voting in the first week of March. Florida is not amongst them. Instead, you've got California, Texas, and Virginia. And I think if Sanders does extremely well on Super Tuesday, pushes Joe Biden out of the race, for example, overtakes Elizabeth Warren and pushes her to the background as the progressive candidate and fends off the so-called moderates like Pete Buttigieg, then that's the political reality. But if it's a wide open race after Super Tuesday and Florida comes into play, then it absolutely becomes important, both in terms of people exploiting the Cuba issue and also on that broader question of, is Sanders electable?
We heard in that clip from Sanders his almost certain defense should the Republicans come after him with this, which is that obviously, and he's correct, it's certainly no worse than Donald Trump's weird, sappy fondness for very much living dictators and similar or dictator-adjacent leaders. But is that actually going to play? Is that going to reassure anybody?
Well, I mean, Andrew, I think before we get to that, look, it should be possible for a grown-up electorate to discuss an issue such as Cuba and hold two thoughts at the same time. And one is that the country did have a vast expansion in literacy rates, that it has, given the U.S. sanctions that have existed on Cuba since 1959, an extremely advanced healthcare system, that it has prided itself on social and community programs, while on the other hand, realizing it is a one-party state that has been tough, more than tough on its political opponents, with political prisoners held for many, many years. You should be able to hold both together. But of course, we're talking politics, and what you get is either this good or evil reaction to Cuba, which is either, oh, everything about Castro is okay, we should try to grow up, we should get over the U.S. sanctions that have been there, the attempts to overthrow him, or alternatively, everything's evil, there's nothing good about Cuba, and why don't the Cubans rise up and overthrow their state? Because we haven't been able to have that grown-up discussion, U.S. policy towards Cuba has been marked by failure after failure, from the Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961 to the Cuban Missile Crisis to the continued difficulties to get a relationship with Cuba in the 21st century. I express that to you, Andrew, because I think it comes back to a wider issue about this election. If we were discussing issues, if we were discussing Cuba in a sensible way, we could possibly make an advance on it and also try to get some political light on this in key states like Florida. But I don't think we'll have that grown-up discussion. And I think Cuba will be used as a battering ram against Bernie Sanders, just as North Korea will be used as a battering ram against Donald Trump, who has not been nuanced at all in what he says about Kim Jong-un.
I mean, absent that grown-up discussion, and I think you're quite right, it would be optimistic to expect that to suddenly break out after all this time where Cuba is concerned. What options does Sanders have in managing the electorate and the media that he is going to have to face? Because it won't just be Cuba. They will come after him with decades of, you know, equivocal-ish remarks about the Soviet Union, or more latterly of Venezuela. Does he have an answer to that other than trying to say what you just said? You know, can we at least try to appreciate that there might be nuances and subtleties here?
Yeah, I mean, there's an easy answer to this, Andrew, and it's a variant of Bill Clinton's advisors in the 1990s, like James Carville, which is it's the economy, stupid. I mean, this year, it's the economy, it's healthcare, it's immigration, it's climate change. It is the question of a very unpredictable and unreliable president. All of those are potential assets when you get into a race against Donald Trump. But again, that takes me back to the question of, you know, those, we're talking issues there. And what Donald Trump will put up against any candidate, not just Sanders, is the spectacle. Look at me, look at my tweets, look at the circus. But I think there's another trap that you and I have just fallen into. Bernie Sanders is not, you know, clearly going to be the candidate at this point against Donald Trump. It is not that type of race. We've only had three small states who have voted. South Carolina comes up as the next one. These are the preliminary skirmishes. And I think you could see any one of a number of outcomes when you get Super Tuesday in early March, which means the day after that, we might not be talking about Sanders versus Trump, but Buttigieg versus Trump or Warren versus Trump, or even, I think, what is a long shot, Biden versus Trump.
Scott Lucas, thanks as always. You're listening to The Briefing with a look now at the day's headlines. Here is Bonicle's Yolin Goffin.
Thanks, Andrew. The Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein has been convicted of rape and sexual assault. He will be sentenced next month and could spend the next 25 years in prison. Weinstein's accusers have welcomed the conviction, but it's thought his legal team will now lodge an appeal. Germany's Christian Democrats will hold a special meeting in April to decide who they want to succeed Chancellor Angela Merkel. The CDU succession debate was blown wide open earlier this month when Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer said she would no longer seek to succeed Merkel. And finally, the Monocle Minute reports that the Oscar-winning film Parasite is helping to ease tensions between South Korea and Japan. Audiences in Japan have embraced the film since its widespread release. To find out more about this story, head over to monocle.com/minute. Those are today's headlines. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Yolin. You're listening to The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. Within the last hour, it has been confirmed that former Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak has died at the age of 91. Here is Monocle 24's obituary.
This is the beginning. We have to work hard. for the implementation, for raising the standard of the people. Otherwise, the people will be hopeless. They will be turned over with the terrorist groups, and it will be a big mistake.
Perhaps more than any other Middle Eastern strongman, Egypt's long-ruling military dictator Hosni Mubarak exemplified the squalid, pragmatic deal he and his kind made with the West. In an inversion of Franklin Roosevelt's celebrated assessment of Nicaraguan despot Anastasio Somoza Garcia, Mubarak's proposition to the democratic world was essentially, I may be a son of a bitch, but I'm your son of a bitch.
The president is a full partner in the peace process. Without the United States, it would be very difficult to continue the peace process. So it's very important to have his influence, his leadership, his activity toward that.
The United States and Europe underwrote Mubarak's regime for 30 years, persuaded by his implicit proposition that while he may have been dreadful, what he was holding back was assuredly more so.
We are not throwing ourselves in the hands of Americans or any other country all over the world.
It must have been some consolation during his dotage in prison that events following his overthrow proved him correct. Hosni Mubarak was born on May 4, 1928, in Kafr El Masela. He entered the Egyptian Military Academy in Cairo straight out of high school. His subsequent career in the Air Force reflected the modernization and the geostrategic rethinking that Egypt underwent during the 50s, 60s and 70s. Mubarak started out flying British-made propeller-powered Spitfires and ended as a pilot on Soviet-built Ilyushin and Tupolev jet bombers. He rose swiftly through the ranks, becoming Chief of Staff of the Air Force in 1969 and then Commander of the Air Force and Deputy Defence Minister in 1972. By 1975, Mubarak was near the pinnacle of the military political complex that ran Egypt, appointed Vice President by Anwar Sadat. He ascended to the presidency after Sadat's assassination by Islamist militants during a military parade in Cairo in 1981. Mubarak was one of those injured in the same attack, far from the last time he would need to be lucky in the high-risk occupation of Middle Eastern head of state. He survived at least another six assassination attempts.
Just after the airport, I left the airport, suddenly I found the blue van blocking the road and somebody just flat on the ground, and machine gun stuff. For me, it was shocking, what's that? Then I realized that there are bullets coming through in our car. It is an armored car. So I was not afraid at all that anything could come in.
At home, Mubarak ruled brutally, repressing dissent by keeping Egypt in a perpetual state of martial law. Abroad, he proved a cunning diplomat, managing the precarious balancing trick of reclaiming Egypt's role as a leader of the Arab world, which had largely been lost under Sadat after the Camp David peace accords with Israel, while keeping the friendship of the United States and the wider West. Mubarak lived by Lord Palmerston's dictum that nations have no permanent friends or enemies, only permanent interests. Throughout the 1980s, Mubarak supported Iraq in its war against Iran. In 1991, he sent Egyptian troops to join the American-led campaign to evict Iraq from Kuwait. The most distinguishing features of Mubarak's rule at home were the most distinguishing features of all autocracies: incompetence, oppression, bureaucracy, and corruption. Estimates of Mubarak's own personal wealth ran into billions more than would generally be considered appropriate reward for a career in public service.
The Egyptian president, Hosni Mubarak, has finally stepped down and handed power to the military, according to the country's vice president.
When he fell in early 2011, aged 82, forced from office by the early convulsions of what would become optimistically known as the Arab Spring, his demise was widely welcomed, even by those who wearily doubted that he would be succeeded by the secular, liberal democracy dreamt of by those who, at terrifying risk, protested against him.
The fight between democracy and dictatorship. The generals who have always been talking about democracy, 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 they are not democratic. They are dictatorship.
As legal retribution descended following his removal, Mubarak made the vainglorious pronouncements traditional in such circumstances of insisting that history would be his judge. If history fails to judge him principally as an unregenerate tyrant and a monstrous crook, it will only be because history has filed Hosni Mubarak amid his obvious peer group of modern Middle Eastern thugs, and recalled that he wasn't as vicious as Saddam Hussein, as loopy as Muammar al-Gaddafi, or quite as ruthless when push came to shove as either Assad Senior or Junior.
So don't expect that we'll have full democracy overnight. Needs generations. I'd like to tell you, the West, if it tries to push democracy in the countries, the third world countries who are not used to democracy at all, if you push it fast to reach the Western democracy, it may have a negative reaction. It may turn at the end to dictatorship.
It's not much of an epitaph. Here lies a man who could probably just about have been worse. For Monocle, I'm Andrew Muller.
Monocle and Rolex bring you The Pioneers. The Pioneers is a brand new series that tells the stories of people improving the planet. Hear how Rolex supports these innovators with whom they share a passion for safeguarding the Earth for future generations. Gain precious insight into the fresh thinking that is disrupting received wisdom for the better. And learn how fearless action continues to be the crucial driver of change. The Pioneers, in partnership with Rolex.
You are listening to The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. It's time now to take a longer look at the day's big stories with our news panel, which today is Daniela Peled, Managing Editor at the Institute of War and Peace Reporting and columnist for Haaretz, and Anna Rosenberg, Head of Europe and the UK at the political consultancy Signum Global. Well, let's start with Brexit, which despite what we were told ad infinitum and indeed ad nauseam in the weeks prior to January 31st, has emphatically not been got done. EU ministers are meeting today to draw up their mandate for trade talks with the UK. Here in London, their UK counterparts are convening at Downing Street to discuss their opening stance. It remains to be seen whether the UK's present government has fully absorbed that sending in gunboats to make them buy our opium isn't quite going to cut it. Anna, first of all, how well do we imagine this is all going to go? These are the trade talks which we were promised 4 years ago would be the easiest in human history. Cup of tea and a plate of biscuits knocked over in an afternoon. Is that how it's going to play out?
No, this is not going to go very well.
You're imagining our shock.
Yes, I am. It is going to get worse before it gets any better. What you've seen since Brexit happened, even though it didn't get done, is a tightening of positions on both sides. As it really kicked off with Johnson's speech on the, I think it was the 1st or the 2nd of February, where he has been, you know, laying out quite an aggressive stance towards the EU, and now the EU is retaliating. I think this is going to get worse. We're going to see negotiations heat up quite a bit with expectations about a no-deal outcome mounting. But eventually, we'll probably reach some sort of mini deals in certain sectors because there is an aspiration for both sides to actually work together. And by that point in time, because the negotiations will have gone so badly, those will be very well received. And they're going to mask the fact that there may not be a few other agreements on sectors where there's not an agreement. So the ultimate outcome is going to be quite mixed.
Daniela, do you anticipate the EU being purely pragmatic about this? Because the way the EU has pitched this the last few years is that, and it is a, I think, a delineation that certainly the Remainer camp here in the UK has bought quite enthusiastically into, that the EU is purely pragmatic and reasonable, whereas the Leave tendency in the UK is insane and insatiable. Do we actually imagine the EU will be purely pragmatic at the business end, or is there going to be a bit of a desire just to give the UK a bit of a kicking?
Well, I think both sides, what they have in common right now is their position is we want the same as before, but not. That's basically the starting point. The EU does have an advantage when it comes to being practical about this, because Boris Johnson, and I'm going to shock you here, is madly playing party politics. And that's his whole approach to Brexit. It's this idea of nationalism and his new brand of conservatism. Whereas the European Union has the disadvantage of all having to agree, but also have a practical position. They're not, they want the EU to carry on as before. So they want to punish Britain a bit, but not too much. But the motivation which we have from our side, from our supposed negotiating team, which, by the way, I don't know if you've noticed, it's called XS, which is alarming, much as it sounds like a cheap aftershow, and is composed entirely of hard Brexiteers. They have their interest in Brexit is very, very far from practical. It's ideological, it's nationalistic, and that will lead it to places which are not looking for practical solutions. Priti Patel's idea about immigration for work purposes, and apparently we have this enormous stock of people who just happen not to be working right now, but they will step up to take all these jobs that European migrants are not going to take. It's made up. It's made up for political purposes. So from that point of view, we are at a disadvantage already.
Anna, Daniela there mentions the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson. To the extent that we do understand what outcome he actually wants, and reasonably enough, he may be being cagey about that for political reasons, as people often are at the outset of any negotiations, but he has made vaguely positive noises about what's called a Canada-style deal. Michel Barnier has explicitly said that is not going to happen. Does that strike you as a bit of an opening gambit by Barnier, or is Barnier actually saying what he means, that no, it's not an option?
I think it's not an option because of the level playing field. It's a no-go for the EU. They would be allowing the UK to become a very serious competitor to the EU. And I think that's just not going to happen. So I think at this point in time, the mini deals that I was alluding to are more likely. I think for Johnson, and we have to think about this, he has just won a 5-year mandate, if not even a 10-year mandate. He has, as Daniela pointed out, fueled nationalist sentiment already. He's tightened control to some extent over the media. He has silenced to some extent critics that are not as enthusiastic about Brexit. We saw that in the cabinet reshuffle. We saw that in exclusions of the CBI, the business group that is Brexit critical. He's controlling the narrative. So what I think is going to happen by the end of the year is that the UK is going to be in a place where it is ready to accept whatever outcome he brings to the table. If it's a deal, fine, which we think is going to happen. If not, the UK is going to embrace this in a nationalist spirit, like the Dunkirk spirit, to some extent. So Johnson,
the Dunkirk spirit, improvised retreat from a self-created shambles on the continent.
Well, in that moment, you're then going to see Johnson open the money taps and start to inject quite a lot of fiscal stimulus into the economy. And so he's probably going to try and spend his way out of any harsh economic consequences. And as a result of that, he, in a few years' time, by the time we get to the next elections, is going to have achieved his goal in a way by breaking loose from the EU, but at the same time regaining sovereignty and just kind of fueling nationalist sentiment.
Well, that's something to look forward to. Daniela, on which subject? I mean, we know what is going to happen when this gets difficult or tough or things go wrong, which is that the UK government and the Leave tendency generally will blame perfidious Johnny Foreigner across the channel for thwarting Albion's ascent to the sunlit uplands, etc., etc. This may be a self-answering question, but is there the remotest chance at all that the blaming the EU thing isn't going to work forever? That at some point, some opinion might shift among the Leaver tendency towards the British government, just saying, thinking, you know, you are actually in charge, solving problems is now your job.
Well, they've also got the Ramonas to blame as well.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, you see, they can spread the joy. Oh, look, I think we've already taken our cue from the Johnson government. He's won, indeed, a mandate for 5 years, probably 10, without any real opposition. Despite all, you know, his appearance, his political behaviour and personal behaviour and his reputation for trust, he is in an amazing position. He's extremely firmly established and not even inclined to bring the country together, really, apart from paying lip service to this. So I think he's in a great position to blame the EU, to blame partners in the UK for not cooperating. And the other thing that he has in his toolkit is the fact is that, and this has been the case really for the last 4 years, things haven't become apocalyptic yet. As much as people who wanted to remain, like me, I was saying, this is going to be a disaster. This is going to be a disaster. It hasn't been. As long as it isn't a disaster, he has an advantage. And when and if it does become disastrous, well, there will be enough time and space in between Brexit and the apocalypse to be able to deny all connection.
Just a final thought on this one, Anna, because you mentioned the prospect of mini deals, and certainly a subject that's going to come up is fishing. Do we yet understand quite where the Leavers' morbid obsession with this subject comes from? Because it got talked about so much and has been talked about so much in the last few years, and it is an infinitesimal fraction of the British economy.
I think the problem in the British fishing industry has fairly little to do with the EU. There are other reasons why fishing quotas and rights and regulations have destroyed the British fishing industry, but somehow it has become a poster child of why we're doing Brexit. I think there is a lot of misconception, but it is a very powerful message. And one of the first things that happened after the famous speech in Greenwich was that Johnson announced that the UK was going to buy and hire more vessels to patrol British fishing waters. And on the same day, I think it was the 1st or 2nd of February, French fishermen were not allowed access into Guernsey fishing waters. So it's going to become a very emotive area. Where the obsession ultimately stems from, well, I think because of the demise of the fishing industry overall, that has at its roots fairly little to do with EU regulations.
Okay, well, let's move along and look at the arrival in Europe of the coronavirus COVID-19. For reasons as yet unclear, the major outbreak so far has occurred in northern Italy, where more than 200 cases are now confirmed. 11 towns in Lombardy and Veneto have now been closed off, effectively quarantining 50,000 people. Elsewhere, many public events in the general vicinity have been cancelled or curtailed. Those affected include Milan Fashion Week, the Venice Carnival, and several Serie A football games, while many museums, schools and other institutions are closed. Daniela, there is a line here between precaution and panic. Are we still on the right side of it?
I'm not sure we are. This all seems very flavoured with panic, especially because there isn't. Everyone seems to be making their own rules about what is involved. Stay at home for 2 weeks. Be quarantined. You're fine if you don't have symptoms. One of my team has just come back from skiing in northern Italy and sent me a WhatsApp this morning. Oh dear, I'm going to call 111. Apparently 111, which is the, is it 111 or 113?
When you're not all that sick.
It's like 999. But much less. And apparently he was told, like, if you're feeling okay, you can go into work, which I think he was very disappointed by. So even within the European Parliament and the European Commission have got two different rules for what their staff should do. No one really knows. And there's a level of immense stupidity and paranoia about this as well. I mean, I think I'm perhaps, I should be a little bit more worried because it's becoming quite hipster to say I'm not worried at all about coronavirus. But the panic and the disinformation and the willful misinformation as well is creating such a, you know, such a tizzy amongst society internationally as well. That I think that currently is the emergency. We might be prepared to deal with a health emergency, but not the corollary, which is a panic emergency.
And tizzy is an undervalued and underrated and underused word. Thank you for that. Anna, is there a problem that the precautions could actually make things worse? Because some of the measures we are seeing instituted, not just in Italy, are extraordinary, most obviously in China and South Korea. But just in the last hour, Turkish Airlines have diverted a flight from Tehran to Istanbul to Ankara, and it has been announced that everybody on board is going to be quarantined for 14 days.
I actually quite disagree with Daniela's point here. I am more worried about this, not from a health perspective, but from an economic perspective. I do think we're taking this far too lightly. The world is not in a very good state economically right now. You see very low growth in Europe at this point in time. The world is heavily dependent on strong GDP growth from China. people are already freaking out if China slows somewhat below 6%. Now, we're already talking about 3% GDP growth in Q1, if not even 0% GDP growth in Q1. Now, the knock-on effects on the global economy are going to be significant.
But is that to do with the... That's all true, but is that to do with, again, the thing itself or the response to it, in the same way that financial crashes themselves get accelerated by everybody freaking out and selling?
Exactly. I mean, I don't know. The answer is for sure there's a panic reaction to this, but I do think that so far they are likely going to behave in a somewhat irrational way. They're going to reduce exposure to restaurants and cinemas and whatever other activity there is in public life, and that's going to have a knock-on effect. But I think that ultimately this is a virus that is killing people, and its deathly rate, it's higher than the flu. So it needs to be contained, because you don't know how much further it can go. And if it already has created havoc in the Chinese economy, if you just let it spread, that's going to create much greater havoc into other economies as well. So I think that the authorities are trying to control it. Of course, there are secondary effects to it. I'm not a health expert. I can't really comment on the fact if those are, you know, appropriate measures or if they're exaggerated. But I am worried for the financial system. I am worried for the economies. Like, just let me give you a number here. I mean, Italy is dependent on 30% of its GDP is dependent on tourism. So you already see, warnings against airlines, falling profits. That's going to likely put the Italian economy into a recession. And that's not going to have very good economic consequences. However, there's a silver lining here. We've been talking a lot about political tensions and trade tensions. If this starts to affect the European economy overall, and also the UK, the UK is also a major exporter and importer from China, what you're going to see is that politically, there's more room for agreement and trade tensions to actually calm down, because people and the economies are going to be suffering from this. So they may be more willing to agree on things politically, with potential upsides for Brexit negotiations.
Final quick thought on this one, Daniela. You mentioned the misinformation and disinformation. How much of the reaction or even overreaction in Europe do you think derives from the fact that the biggest clusters of this virus so far, well, two of the biggest clusters in China and Iran, are in two countries whose word for anything you can't necessarily always take to the bank? Are people worrying that it might actually be worse than it looks?
I'm sure it is worse than it looks. That's highly likely. No, I think that the panic is that not if it's happening in Europe, if it happens far away, well, that's okay. It's a thing that happens far away. I think the fact that it is spreading and that everyone is enthusiastically reported, as they would do, of course, that we have a cluster here and we've got isolated cases here and we have people on cruise ships broadcasting and YouTubing it live. That's what I mean. It's become a social panic as opposed to a carefully calibrated risk, and that's inevitable. And because people are not health experts. People are worried about these things, and panic continues. And I'm sure that when we unpick the details of all this, there will be an awful lot of social media trolling and misinformation from Russia and other actors as well, because it really, really works.
Well, finally, on today's news panel, a slightly more heartwarming story. An apparent thaw in the traditionally frosty relations between South Korea and Japan, prompted by a somewhat unlikely source of warmth. South Korean director Bong Joon-ho, Oscar-winning film Parasite is proving an enormous hit in Japan, and Bong and the film stars have been widely feted on a promotional tour of Japan. As reported in this morning's Monocle Minute, and as we heard earlier on the show, Bong was at pains to express his appreciation of the appreciation. And a kind of moment like this, at which two countries who don't usually get on, you know, decide that one's done something that the other actually quite likes, can that be a thing? Can it have a knock-on effect?
I do think so. I think it helps understanding another culture. I was thinking earlier in preparation for the show and also discussing with Daniela if there are other examples that we can come up where there are other books or movies have created a similar empathy. And quite frankly, we didn't quite come up with a lot of examples. However, what I came up thinking about this morning was this series recently called Deutschland 83, Germany 83, which was about the GDR. And
it was really good. I enjoyed it.
Ironically, it was incredibly popular outside of Germany. So I think it created a lot of understanding of how people lived during the GDR regime, whereas in Germany, people were like, this is not how things were over here. And they're kind of not portraying us in the right way. So, but at least I think it created a bit more understanding of a German experience that is generally underreported.
See, Daniela, where I come from, it's usually the opposite. It usually just consists of my people annoying New Zealanders by referring to Crowded House as an Australian band. But are there examples you can think of in which hostile peoples have been brought together by a work of art?
I'm trying very, very, very hard, and it's not easy. All I can come up with is that everywhere I've travelled, for instance, in the Middle East, with people really not very keen on Americans, everyone loves those sort of Hollywood action films. I mean, that is the uniting force. In Afghanistan, during the Taliban era, everyone liked Titanic. I'm sure sneakily quite a few Taliban commanders did too. beyond that, I'm struggling. Hummus? Oh no, that's cultural appropriation.
Time at all, not on this item or indeed in the rest of our lives to deal with the whole hummus rivalry thing. That is a show in itself. Is it more often the fact that art is used as kind of an instrument of sort of soft power war, really? I mean, famously during the Cold War, the America in particular were keen on attempting to undermine the Eastern Bloc and the Soviet sphere with American jazz.
Yes, absolutely. And I think in a way you're currently witnessing cultural influence war already going on with Netflix, Amazon Prime, Channel 4 trying to do Walter Presents series where they're trying to showcase European shows. I think culture and art has always been a way to influence other societies and in a way to show who's the more powerful. So absolutely. I think generally art is created to point attention to things that aren't going quite right, but I do think it does also bring people together in many ways.
We can only hope. Anna Rosenberg and Daniela Pellard, thank you both very much for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing.
On Meet the Writers this week, join me, Georgina Godwin, as I talk to the legendary Latin American author Isabel Allende. She's the world's most widely read Spanish language novelist. And on the show, she discusses her new book, The Long Petal of the Sea, how letters to her mother influenced her writing career, the devastating death of her daughter, and the work of the foundation set up in her memory, and if she has indeed met the last man in her life. That's Isabel Allende on Meet the Writers, premiering this Sunday at 1400 London time, and thereafter available as a podcast.
You are listening to The Briefing with me, Andrew Mullett. Now, one of the many, 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 many unintended consequences of Brexit was that it abruptly reminded the rest of the United Kingdom of the existence of Northern Ireland, a thing about which the rest of the United Kingdom had gotten kind of used to thinking about a lot less than it was once compelled to. There was a period, indeed, when the question of the Northern Irish border threatened to entirely scupper what was essentially a nationalist revolt by the English, which would have been something of a collector's item for aficionados of historical ironies. Anybody seeking a single volume untangling of Northern Ireland's complexities will struggle to do much better than Glenn Patterson's Backstop Land, and the same goes for anybody wanting a hugely engaging and funny novel set in modern Belfast with regard to Glenn Patterson's imminent Where Are We Now? And with that, double book plug, a rarity. Glenn does join me.
That's a very entertaining introduction. That was lovely.
Well, it's given us something to live up to in the next 10 minutes or so. Let's start with Backstop Land, your alternative name for Northern Ireland. What was your motive for writing it? Which is always, it's a stock question for any book, but it's always a good one because sitting down to write a book is no small undertaking, especially one about Northern Ireland.
The motivation was a conversation I was having with my editor, Neil Belton, at Head of Zeus, who had previously published Fintan O'Toole's book on Brexit. And he wondered whether there might be a book to be written about about the whole Brexit saga from the Northern Irish point of view. And as soon as he said it, I remembered being in London the day after the 2017 election. I arrived the morning after the election, and as I got off the plane, it was pretty obvious that the DUP, the Democratic Unionist Party, were going to be holding the balance of power. And friends who I met
prompted an amount of frantic Googling.
A lot of Googling, indeed. I think that might be the least of what it prompted. But friends of mine who I was meeting that day were asking rather forcefully who these people were. And it became apparent to me that really nobody had any idea or seemed not to have any idea that not only were the DUP in government in Northern Ireland, which they had been at that stage for a number of years, but you know this was normal for us, and somehow but there'd always been a presence in Westminster, so I thought maybe that was a good starting point. That question of who are these people, and that became my prologue, and I ended it with "Welcome to Our World." So I guess that is what the book is. It's half a Welcome to Our World, a crash course on Northern Ireland, but also a journal of the time that I was writing it, because I wrote it very quickly. I started it in May of last year and finished it at the end of August.
Well, this brings me to the thing I wanted to ask about the structure of it, because you write it pretty much in real time. You sort of, there's bits in the book where you talk about what you've already written and now you're not sure about it, or you're thinking about a thing you're going to have to deal with and how you're going to deal with that. Was there an amount of this as well that was an attempt to explain the story of Northern Ireland to yourself?
I don't know if it was so much to explain it to myself. It was an opportunity maybe to take stock. And, you know, we had, at the time that I was writing it, we had no government in Northern Ireland. So the assembly at Stormont had been suspended since January 2017. It's only up and running again in the last few weeks. So there was a lot that had been going on that I had been thinking about and maybe writing articles here and there about. But this was an opportunity, to take stock of it rather than to explain it to myself, just to have a little overview of it. I was writing it in, I wouldn't call it real time because it felt like unreal or even surreal time, but I was writing it, and really I would be sitting at my desk writing, and somebody would phone up. Indeed, there's a section where somebody had phoned me to talk to my wife and started talking about how despairing she was of the whole Brexit thing. And I just started to type what she was saying, and I said, this is brilliant. Can I use this? And she said, yeah, go ahead. Go ahead. So everything that was happening around me seemed to be seemed to go into the book, just because that was I was writing at that kind of pace that there was barely time to edit myself.
How anxious have these years since the Brexit vote been in Northern Ireland? Because as I'm sure you know, and as any Irish person will tell you, neither the Republic of Ireland nor Northern Ireland were really discussed leading up to the referendum, largely because I think nobody really thought the vote was going to go the way it did. But obviously, once people started to appreciate the difficulties posed by the Irish border and what that could portend if things went wrong, was there an anxiety in Northern Ireland about thinking, you know, along the lines of thinking, well, maybe we haven't quite put it all behind us?
Well, we haven't put it behind us anyway, because we've had paramilitary activity for the last 20 years. 160 people have been murdered by paramilitary organisations in Northern Ireland since the signing of the Good Friday Agreement that was supposed to have brought all this to an end.
This is something that barely gets reported outside Northern Ireland.
And last year, April last year, just before I started working on the book, a young journalist called Lyra McKee was murdered by a group called the New IRA. The IRA has so many versions, but this was the New IRA. Now, they didn't come into existence because of any anxiety over Brexit. They'd been formed in 2012 out of some sweepings of old IRAs. And they were active. They have been targeting police officers. And this was somebody stuck a gun around a corner in a street in Derry, fired in the general direction of the police and hit Lyra McKee. So that kind of activity had been ongoing. I think the fear about what might happen if there was the hard border, the backstop, maybe brought that to the fore a little bit. what's happened since Boris Johnson's revised deal, where the backstop has now become the front stop instead of the border in north-south becoming a hard border. We now have a customs border, invisible customs border in the Irish Sea. Almost the day after that deal was done, there were posters all around the part of Belfast that I live in, which would be perhaps connected more with loyalist paramilitaries rather than Republican paramilitaries, threatening insurrection. And Boris Johnson, who had been a bit of a hero in those parts, was suddenly the traitor. So it's violence from these groups has never entirely gone away. And maybe all that's happened with Brexit is that it's made it a little bit more visible to people outside of Northern Ireland.
It's something of a motif in the novel Where Are We Now as well. There's references to, I guess, that past or that barely suppressed present making itself felt. Do you think you mentioned the ongoing murders, punishment, beatings and so on carried out by paramilitary forces. Is it a source of frustration within Northern Ireland that this stuff is barely reported outside Northern Ireland? Because I can remember years ago doing a story in Northern Ireland and just in order to pick up some local colour, did that thing of buying just an armful of local newspapers and chronicling every sectarian event that was reported in those on just a given day in Northern Ireland circa, I don't know, 2004, 2005. I was astonished, perhaps rather naively, by how many there were.
It is a frustration that it isn't more reported. I have to say, Northern Ireland, Belfast in particular, Belfast is my city, it is a much improved place. Mm. But I didn't vote when I voted for the Good Friday Agreement for things just being a wee bit better. I voted for something being, you know, a good deal better. And the fact that we have had this this hangover of paramilitary activity, often with the connivance of governments north and south, whatever it takes to keep the politicians on board, is sometimes a little bit of violence has been tolerated. And the punishment attacks, which I do bring into Where Are We Now, are a particularly pernicious form of paramilitary control exercised over usually working class communities. And usually the victims of it are young working class men who are beaten, shot in the legs. And you know, that's been going on. I think there were maybe 80 of them last year. So that's more than one a week.
Glenn Patterson, thank you for joining us. Backstop Land is available now. Where Are We Now is out next month. You're listening to The Briefing.
Monocle and Rolex bring you The Pioneers. For the founder of Rolex, Hans Wilsdorf, the world was like a living laboratory. He began to use it as a testing ground for his watches from the 1930s, sending them to the most extreme locations, supporting explorers who ventured into the unknown. But the world has changed. As the 21st century unfolds, exploration for pure discovery has given way to exploration as a means to preserve the natural world. Rolex continues this legacy of its founder, supporting the explorers of today on their new mission to make the planet perpetual. Learn more with the Pioneers, in partnership with Rolex.
You're listening to The Briefing. It's time now to review the morning newspapers, and I'm joined in the studio to do exactly that by Monocle 24's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Fernando, is it Brazil we're going to?
It is Brazil, and it's only Carnival, Andrew, because it is the big story. But it's funny, I say only Carnival. It's not only about parties, it's actually quite political as well. So let's start with O Globo. In fact, one of their columnists said that the main trend on this year's parade is the hyper-realism. So, for example, we had...
Wasn't it hyper-real enough as it's to start with?
Well, because, for example, there's one scene where they pretended there was a police operation in the favelas, you know, criticizing police violence in the country. But of course, there was humor there as well. So as you can see, we have the very famous comedian Marcelo Diné. He was basically Bolsonaro, pretending he was Bolsonaro. And there were a lot of posters around him, one of them saying, "The flat is earth." I'm not saying that Bolsonaro thinks that, but I'm sure a lot of his supporters do think that. And, you know, and it is true. And he's quite funny as well. If we move on to Folha de São Paulo, you will see what I'm talking about. They decided to go for Mangueira, which is one of the most respected samba schools. There's something called Comissão de Frente, which is the first part of the samba school when they enter the samba drama. And they had basically Jesus being arrested by heavily armed police officers. So they were saying, you know, that's the reality of Brazil today. If Jesus would be here, he would be arrested because, you know, he's in favor of the poor, of the minorities.
That's quite an arresting image. I mean, we talked last week leading up to Carnival with you and Lucinda Elliott about the political dimensions of Carnival. If you look at an image like that, which is, yeah, I mean, it's difficult to mistake the text. It's not even a subtext. It's the text. But are there large amounts of, I guess, evangelical pro-Bolsonaro variety Brazilians who are going to be absolutely up in arms about this image?
Well, of course. Probably they hate Carnival. Probably they'll be switching off their television. But I have to say, the thing that strikes me, most of samba schools, they come from the favelas, actually. That's where, you know, they make the costumes during the whole year. And they are the ones who suffer, you know, police violence. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I wonder as well if, because every year is political, but this year more so than in previous years, from what I could see.
What I was going to ask. Are the newspapers picking up on the fact that the fact of Bolsonaro's presidency and all that goes with it has reignited Carnival's political aspect?
Very much so, and they took very courageous decisions, in my opinion, because remember, it's also a very commercial parade. They get a lot of money with sponsorship, so I think they are taking some risks. And I mean, we're just talking about the political side. I mean, let's go to Meia Hora, which is the Rio's tabloid. You know, of course, you know, the muses of this year, they are...
That is the most stereotypically Rio photograph they could have gone with on the front there. I don't know where you begin to start describing that.
Well, you know, it's, for example, Sabrina Sato is a very famous TV presenter. She always has fabulous costumes. And the trend is apparently a lot of sequins and shoulder pads as well. And again, when it's Carnival, it's like our red carpet for the Oscars. So we do cover the fashion, those costumes, even though perhaps there's not much material here, but they're very expensive because sometimes they're wearing diamonds. I mean, and the stakes are getting higher and higher every year because, you know...
This is presumably not what she wears to present television programs.
Not always. Not always. I have to say, I'm a big fan. She's actually quite funny.
It's hard to explain without visual prompts here to our listeners, but I would describe those outfits as impractical.
Very much impractical. But I'm sure she has like a team of 10 people like surrounding to make sure every single detail is perfect. And there's a lot of pressure on women. Some people say that Carnival is still very much sexist, you know, because the papers they love, you know, they are very much like Daily Mail-esque, you know, saying they do a little circle. Why didn't she wear this correctly in a way? So maybe there's a little criticism here from me as well. But there's also half-naked men as well. So, not, you know, there's something for everyone.
Indeed so. Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you as always. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Now, of all the stereotypes that attach to all the world's nations, few are more adhesive than the idea that Germany is a byword for efficiency. Modern Germany has indeed lent unabashedly into the reputation, forging itself, efficiently, one might almost say, the considerable soft power asset of a radiant aura of being a country which quietly and prudently builds things, makes things, gets things done, on time, under budget, and so on. But, and it is a question worth asking of stereotypes every so often, is any of this accurate? Rome was built faster than the reconstruction of the Berlin Palace. The only thing which has taken off at Brandenburg Airport is the cost, and Tesla may even be wishing it had decided to build its new gigafactory in Italy or somewhere. Well, joining me with more on this is Frederick Studemann, literary editor at the Financial Times. Frederick, those examples I have mentioned there, the Berlin Palace, Brandenburg Airport, the Tesla Gigafactory, are they the exceptions that prove the rule, or are they actually pretty typical?
Well, I think those are very significant ones, obviously. I mean, the airport is a particular howler. I think the palace is just a bit more complicated because it was such a weird venture to begin with. I mean, it's sort of is a project that had sort of many different iterations and lifetimes, if you like. But I think you can say that, you know, while Germany does like to think of itself as a sort of well-ordered and, as you said, efficient place, you know, that's more than a few examples to counter that stereotype. I mean, you could add a lot of it is around actually construction, weirdly. There's a big case in Stuttgart where they've been trying to build a modern railway station for a while, and that's been mired and all manner of challenges to the planning around that. And I think if you were trying to sort of thread together a theme around this, a lot of it is actually not in the inefficiency in carrying out the work, if we're going to get down into the sort of gritty details. It's often to do with that other sort of German predilection, which is to sort of fuss around rules and regulations and create systems. It's a very legalistic place, Germany. I mean, I am now obviously grossly indulged in stereotypes, but I think that's probably the only way to do this. It's a very legalistic culture. So whenever you propose something like Tesla, you know, big ticket investment, wants to really sort of make a statement, and everyone in Berlin, or a lot of people in Berlin, very excited that this was just a of the future coming to town, and then the first thing they walk into is a couple of legal challenges as to whether they can chop down a forest of trees. Initially they were hindered, but now we just heard news a few days back that actually that challenge was overruled, so they will be able to clear a plantation of conifers to make way for the factory. But it's often in that area that sort of, you know, inefficiency shows itself with these big projects. But I could point out other examples of where, you know, celebrated German efficiency, particularly in the service culture, is somewhat lacking. You find it certainly when you rub up against German bureaucracy. I mean, I'm now living in the UK, but worked in Berlin for over a decade and then in Hamburg. I mean, you never really wanted to ring anyone after lunch on a Friday who worked in a public building, and even in quite a few parts of the private sector, it was almost sort of treated as what an impertinence, and certainly don't ring around lunchtime. And lunchtime can be quite an extensive thing time-wise in terms of how people want to interpret it. So I would say, you know, there is something to the stereotype that, you know, Germany manages to do various things in quite a highly competent and sophisticated way, but equally they're not totally perfect.
In your experience, though, what do Germans themselves think of the German efficiency stereotype? I think most countries are aware of the stereotypes attached to them and usually tend to resent them.
I think Germans are certainly aware of them. I think they resent maybe a little bit too strong on this case, but I think they're aware that, they sort of... It's also a subject of discussion within Germany that one isn't always very efficient at getting things done. I think resent might be putting it a little bit strongly, but they're certainly aware of it.
Where do you think it comes from? Is it exclusively a post-war thing Germany has picked up, or is it something people have always endowed Germany and Germans with?
I'd say it's possibly a bit of both. I think they've been, you know, look, you go back to the 18th and 19th century, and Germany was a sort of, was setting the pace in a lot of sort of scientific discovery. And then later, obviously, it was, Britain was first in to the Industrial Revolution. But, you know, by the time, you know, once Germany had sort of various political developments and social developments were all a bit too complicated to explain, it sort of got underway, they not only caught up, but actually, you know, were preeminent. And I think, you know, there was a lot of sort of very fresh, rational thinking about how you structure processes. And I think that's, if you like, where, if we're talking about that stereotype about efficiency, is where a lot of the action is when you're talking about Germany, is in getting processes right and very optimal, and having a culture of where, I mean, again, to sort of slightly talk broad brush and exaggerate to prove a point, is when you're looking at a problem or a challenge, it's often dealt with in that you first go on a long journey of discovery of assessing the scope of the the scope of the problem or the challenge, how you, you know, all the various possible answers to that. And then you finally, you know, rationalize all of that and come up with an answer or a, you know, process that you're going to implement. And then everyone gets on board and does it. To outsiders, this is often agonizingly and frustratingly long, you know, and it is this consensus culture. And you just, in when it comes to building things or not getting them built, as there's a case may be, it's also, you see it in the politics, it's an endless sort of things have been discussed and thought over and thrashed out. When it works quite well, because then everyone's on board and you've kind of, there's nothing more to be discussed, you just get on and do it.
Frederick Studeman, we will have to leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us. That is all for today's show. The Briefing was produced by Rhys James, Carlotta Ribello and Jolene Goffin. It was researched by Charlie German and Madeline Pollard. The studio manager was Steph Chongu. I'm Andrew Mullett. Thanks very much for listening.